Hey guys, welcome to this very special episode of Unemployable. In the next hour, you are going to be spending time with the famous Lawrence Lepard. Lawrence is an absolute legend in the investing space in the United States. He's a Harvard Business School graduate. He actually went to Harvard with Steve Ballmer, who is sort of the number two of Microsoft. He talks about buying Microsoft and selling it. His time through the 80s as a venture capitalist and fund manager. You know, this is a guy that, you know, bought 30% of a company, Netcom, for $2 million, sold it a few years later for $280 million. He is the real deal. He's been in the finance and investment space his whole life. And in this interview, we dive into why 70% of his net worth is now in Bitcoin. It is an incredible interview. I think you're going to really enjoy it. And he is one of the good guys in the world, one of the good guys in the Bitcoin community, just a decent, amazing human being. So with that said, let's get into this very special interview. Remember, like, subscribe, comment, so that YouTube knows this is the kind of content that you want and we can get this content to more people. Thanks for watching and I hope you enjoy the show. What is up, everybody? Welcome to this very special episode of Unemployable and the space where we talk exclusively about Bitcoin. And today, we are super privileged to be joined by Lawrence Lepard, who has joined us from Naples, Florida, a beautiful part of the world. Okay. Lawrence is the author of The Big Print. Welcome to the show, Lawrence.
Great. Oh, thanks, Adam. Really great to be on the show with you. I'm looking forward to this.
Mate, I've got to say, the book itself, the cover, is it a tip of the hat to The Big Short? It looks like
the similar. Yeah, that's exactly right. And the orange color obviously is a clue to Bitcoiners, but you notice that Bitcoin's not on the cover. Yeah. There's actually an Aussie cover designer, a woman named Jennifer Barton, you may be familiar with down there. She's a graphic artist. She did a fabulous job.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely incredible. I literally just finished it this morning. I got it from Sean from G'day Bitcoin. He mailed it to me and I've been reading it. I've had it for 4 days and I've read it cover to cover just terrific. So we're going to talk more about the book. And look, first of all, I just want to say a heartfelt thank you to you personally, because you're one of those voices on YouTube that has helped me through two bear markets. And I mean, YouTube's the modern day pamphlets. And I know you give up a lot of your time to do these kinds of interviews. And for me, on my journey, when I had all those emotions that you have when you're new to the Bitcoin journey, you need those voices of confidence and competence that you provided. So thank you very much.
Very, very kind of you. I appreciate the support. I mean, I kind of view it as just a personal mission to try and help people on this stuff, because what a messed up monetary system we got, right?
It is a mess.
It's a big mess, sadly.
Maybe, Larry, just to give people who, because my audience at the moment is a developing Bitcoin audience, mostly we're entrepreneurs and investors, and I'd love you to just give us a high-level background of yourself, like 41 years, just to frame it.
Bitcoiners, most of them know that. So I'm in the United States. I'm coming from Naples because I'm a snowbird. I spend the summer in Boston and the winter in Florida. I've spent my whole career as a professional investor, managing investment funds, mostly technology stuff, actually. I kind of got in the technology field in the early 80s and rode through all that, you know, PCs and disk drives and graphic cards, and, you know, ultimately ended up investing in the internet, and that was very, very lucrative, worked out well. And then in the latter part of my career, I kind of was moving toward just still doing technology things, but the great financial crisis happened in 2008. And I was shocked. I mean, I was just like, oh my God, this is really crazy. You know, their interest rates are zero and they're printing money like crazy. And there's going to be a lot of inflation as a result of that. And so I kind of pivoted. I went from being a technology investor to being a sound money investor. And at the time, you know, because the white paper had only come out in 2008, Bitcoin wasn't very established. If you were a sound money investor in 2008, your choices were kind of gold and silver. And so I started a fund picking gold and silver mining companies, and I invested in gold and silver and all that sort of stuff. So, and since then, I've just stuck with that theme, and it's gotten progressively worse, you know, the money printing, right? The book is titled The Big Print. Well, we've already had a couple. I mean, we had a big print in 2008, and then we had a bigger print in 2020. And I think there's an even bigger print coming, and that's why I wrote the book, to try and help people and protect people. And you know, there are a lot of Bitcoin books out there. Some of them are very technical and some of them are, you know, they're all very good. And particularly the Bitcoin Standard by Safe and you know, Broken Money by Lynn are fabulous books. But what I tried to achieve with this book was to kind of write an everyman's guide to, you know, how the monetary system is messing him up and why inflation is really a problem that's slated to get worse. And then obviously, you know, as you know, the book is divided into two parts. The first part is kind of the problem where I describe how we got here. And then the second problem, okay, given that, you know, inflation is a problem that's going to hang around for a while, what's the solution? And then I walk people through why I think Bitcoin is the best solution. Gold's a good solution too, but I think Bitcoin's better. And so, you know, that's really the genesis of the book. I mean, I think I've told other podcasters, and I just say it as a general rule. What happened to me was sometime last year, I was watching the political debate. As you know, we had a presidential election here last year, and I was watching the political debate in the early part of the year. I was watching the red team yell at the blue team, and the blue team yell at the red team. And I was just so disgusted because none of them were really focusing on what I thought was the core issue that's creating a lot of the problems, which is the broken monetary system. And so I've used the metaphor to say, you know, the house is on fire and they're arguing over the color of the drapes, you know? And so that was what kind of led me. I just, you know, somebody's got to sit down and tell this story. And I have the benefit, I'm 67 years old. I have the benefit of having seen it all unfold over the past, you know, 30 or 40 years. And so I try to bring all that into the story and explain how we got to this situation we're in, where the money is really kind of messed up. The monetary system is messed up. And, you know, so that's the genesis of the book. And you know, if it achieves its goal, my goal is to help average people understand what went wrong and then understand how they can protect themselves and how we can drive the whole world really to a fairer and a sounder system. Because, you know, right now, I mean, I got 20-year-old kids that can't buy a house, and, you know, a lot of people hurt, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find a citizen of the world who says, I haven't really been hit by inflation. I mean, unless you're silly rich, you know, inflation has become a problem for many, many people. So that's what.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you know too much about the Australian situation, but the real estate market here is
absolutely out of control. I've heard it's insane, right? I mean, just nuts, right?
Yeah. I mean, the average house price in Sydney is approaching $2 million.
Oh my
average.
Goodness.
The rest of the country is $1 million, sort of, you know, it's just nuts. But your point there about, and this is why I love your work so much. I recently came out in defense of our two largest supermarket chains in Australia, Coles and Woolworths, which was a very unpopular stance because people hate Coles and Woolworths because they make billions of dollars a year in sales. They operate at like a 3% margin. And what I was trying to say to people was basically passing along Safe's message, which is the problem isn't your supermarket at the checkout, it's your central bank. The average man doesn't understand that. And it's
the politicians, you know, the politicians, they sit there and they, you know, we've got this woman up here named Elizabeth Warren, and she says it's the greedy corporations, you know, that are, as you point out, the corporations. I mean, these supermarkets are making a 3% margin. This isn't supermarket greed. This is, you know, the central banks in the COVID experience, the central banks grew the money supply in the United States, M2, by 40%. I mean, they diluted everybody's savings and earnings power by 40%. That's like, ouch. You know, I mean, and so, you know, somebody who's living right at the edge, who's having a hard time buying food and making ends meet, you know, when suddenly everything they have to buy goes up in price by 40%, that can shove them over the edge. And it's really tragic, Adam. And you know, and that, again, that also was what drove me to write the book, just the belief that somebody's got to call these guys out on it. You know what I mean? I mean, the politicians are saying, oh, no, it's corporation bullshit. It's the central banks.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, if they actually debited people's account 40% of their capital, then they'd really get it that this is theft.
That's right.
Don't, because they have this word called inflation, which sort of is like sleight of hand, and prices went up. Nothing to see here.
It's very sneaky. It's very sneaky. And you know, let's face it, schools don't teach about the monetary system. You know, most people don't even know who Keynes is. You know, there are very few sound money advocates left. There are only us old crazy gold and silver bugs, you know, who were sound money advocates pre-Bitcoin. And I mean, that's one of the things I like to say about Bitcoin is, and when Bitcoin came along and Safe wrote his book and everybody started reading it and studying it, suddenly I had 20 and 30-year-olds quoting von Mises to me. And I was like, oh my God, this is really great. You know, the reinforcements have arrived because, you know, gold bugs, it's been hard to be a gold bug for the past 30 years. I mean, we got our asses kicked, you know, the fiat people have been winning. So
for those of you who are wondering what we're talking about with Safe's book, it's a great book. It's a book that every Bitcoiner will tell you to read. It's called The Bitcoin Standard by Safe Dean Amous, who's an intellect. And it's ironically, it's called The Bitcoin Standard, but probably only 20% of the book is about Bitcoin.
Correct.
The rest is about money and about how money works. And it should be taught in schools, but it's not.
Yes.
But it is heavy duty. I listen to it on audio because I consume it better. But if you have this, like in The Matrix, there's a splinter in your mind and you know there's something wrong, but you can't quite put your finger on it. You know, you're working harder, you're getting less, you know, product for more money and you can't figure it out. Read the big print and read The Bitcoin Standard, and in 20 hours you'll have an education that will change your life.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, his is a much more in-depth and scholarly work than mine, and I actually kind of intended mine to be an introduction to the problem, and then in recommended reading he's right at the top of the list. I think if you read mine and you're intrigued, then you say, okay, well now I got to read The Bitcoin Standard, and he goes much deeper than I go. I tried to make mine a narrative and a story because I've given The Bitcoin Standard to a lot of my friends. And to be frank, I think a lot of them bog down. They don't read it. I mean, unless you're really into this kind of stuff, you know, it feels a little textbooky. And so you can kind of go, I'm not going to finish this. Whereas in my particular case, I tell all these anecdotes and stories. And I wrote the first half in a way that, you know, I think any citizen can read and go, man, I'm pissed off. You know, I'm getting taken advantage of here and I'm mad. And that's the bad news. The good news is, okay, you know, I don't just leave you hanging with, okay, it's wrong and it's broken, but there's a very positive emerging solution. You know, what's going on in the world, in my view, is extremely positive. You know, the fact that you're in Australia and I'm in the United States and we're talking real time and recording it and broadcasting to thousands of people. I mean, these big decentralized structures that have really taken advantage of all of us for so many years, you know, they're breaking down and they're falling apart. And, you know, people are able to get truth in a lot of different means that they couldn't get it before. I mean, it used to be that, you know, the New York Times was the standard for truth, and that's not the case anymore. So it's a good thing.
I want to jump into why Bitcoin in a minute.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about, I mean, why Bitcoin is a solution, but one of the really powerful things, I mean, first of all, I won't reveal the story, but the story.
Oh, you can reveal it. It's up on Amazon, the opening story. Yeah.
The story at the start where you're a Harvard Business School guy, but when you went back and stood up to those guys and literally in front of hundreds of people called them out for their bullshit was really.
It wasn't very popular, Adam. I got a lot of angry stares. I mean, and I, you know, I thought to myself, God, I'm not sure why I'm doing this. And in fact, in a podcast with Preston says, I'm reading that, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, Larry, please don't. Please don't.
Oh, I can imagine that was when
I helped myself. You know?
I'm so glad you did, because that is speaking truth to power about mismanagement. So, but it's what was interesting was your story, and maybe you could share it here, because your family was personally touched by the meddling of the Fed. And you're smart enough to know how you were touched by the Fed, whereas the average punter doesn't really. So maybe you could share just sort of those stories.
Sure. Let's go through that. So my grandfather ran a business in the Midwest. This is long before I was born, in the 20s. And he and my grandmother received a lot of fake signals. You know, the roaring 20s caused him to borrow money to grow his business because demand was through the roof. He was a retailer, he was a shopkeeper, sold furniture. And he got himself very levered right up into 29. And of course, then the collapse came. And that whole bubble was blown by the Fed, by the way, as a result of trying to help England. And it's in the book. There's kind of an explanation of why it occurred. But when that bubble burst, you know, he went from a bunch of employees down to two employees. And he spent the next 10 years begging the bank not to foreclose on him. He was fortunate enough to make it through it, but had a very big scar on him and my grandmother, which I talk about in the book. And so, you know, there's an example of how the Fed created, I mean, the Fed says, well, we're here, you know, to prevent things like the Great Depression, which is just total nonsense. I mean, the Fed contributed to and actually promulgated the Great Depression. So that was a case of where my grandfather got hurt. And I remember hearing the stories about it. Then a bunch of years later, my father was running the same business in the 70s. And, you know, we had an inflation problem in the 70s because we'd gone off the gold standard in 1971. And so, you know, Paul Volcker came in and he knew the dollar was in trouble. And so he had to solve that problem. And so he shoved interest rates up to 20%. Well, this business was a furniture retailing business. My father borrowed a lot of money to carry his floor plan of furniture that he was trying to sell. And interest rates went from 4% to 20%. So suddenly he had huge interest payments to the bank, and he came within a hair's breadth of going bankrupt. And I was, at that time, I was a late teenager, and I watched all of that occur, and I was like, holy shit, this, you know, that was pretty bad. And then, of course, then my turn came in 2008. I was managing a fund, and I was fortunate enough to identify the housing bubble. It was pretty obvious. Book talks about it, has statistics on it. And the trade that made Michael Burry so famous, you know, The Big Short with the housing bubble, and he knew what a CDS was. I didn't even know what a CDS was, but the fund I managed, I had managed to get myself short a lot of the housing bubble stocks, knowing that they were bubble and were going to burst. And I was having a great year, and then suddenly they changed the rules. You know, on September 21, the SEC came out and said, now short selling financial stocks is illegal. And so I went from being up 50% to being down 6% that year. I should have made a ton of money. And this is just, you know, all of these are just symptoms of how there's a system that, you know, we mere peons play within, that these, you know, 12 people who sit on the Federal Reserve Board control, that, you know, allows them to benefit at our expense.
Yeah.
And so those who are playing fair and playing by the rules, we get hurt. You know, my grandfather got hurt, my dad got hurt, I got hurt. But guess what? The bankers made a fortune. You know, in that year, in 2008, when the bubble burst, you know, they paid $22 billion worth of banker bonuses. I mean, they had created an enormous bubble and made tons of money off doing so, knowing that they would be bailed out, and they were. And so, again, it goes back to violating the fundamental principle of the United States, which is, you know, equality under law. You know, things are supposed to be fair, and they're not fair. I mean, if you're a banker or an insider or a government person, you know, you've got one set of rules you can play by. I mean, we see all our senators in the United States making millions and millions of dollars off a couple hundred thousand dollars of salary. And that's just basically because they can insider trade and they get special deals. And then the rest of us are, you know, forced to pay for it all with higher inflation. We go to the grocery store and, you know, prices are going up, and it's just wrong. It's just fundamentally wrong. You know, that's the issue.
This is, and this is, you know, in our Australian national anthem, you know, the answer to Bitcoin is right in the first sentence, wealth for toil, right? Like, you know, proof of work is how money should work.
Yes.
And, you know, there's no proof of work anymore. And you said on page 311 of the book, I love that bit where you basically wrote the script for this fictitious president of how you would actually announce to the world that you're going back to gold, silver, and Bitcoin. But in page 311, you said that if you did do this, if the world moved, and we'll go into that towards the end of the pod, how this transformation could happen. But I want to talk about why you believe it's inevitable first. But you said in the book on page 311 that if we did move back to this, that wealth would shift to labor rather than to the financial elites. Because what you're describing here is that the financial elites have benefited from this mouse click money that you call it, the ability to just manufacture wealth, move money around on computers rather than having to do any wealth for toil. It's just wealth for a scam, right? Like, so what I'd like to talk about is one of the reasons I think you've become YouTube famous in the Bitcoin space because of your level of certainty about what's coming. Maybe you could speak to us and educate the audience a little bit about Brian Hirschman's sort of model and study of the relationship between GDP and debt, and how that historically has played out and where the US is in that cycle.
It's a brilliant question, Adam, and it's right on. I mean, people say to me, hey Larry, you're being extremist, and you know, how do you know this is going to happen? How do you have so much confidence and certainty in it? And it's really just a function of pattern recognition. You can't grow. So debt is something that grows, and people historically have used debt to bring consumption forward and to grow economies. And if the debt is then used, if the proceeds of the debt are used to increase productivity, increase GDP at a similar rate, it all works. The situation, everything balances, so to speak. And it can be a good thing. I mean, the early days of the Reagan years where they took on debt and grew the economy, you know, they had a lot of real growth. A problem is that over time, the debt starts being used for unproductive things. And when the debt grows at a rate that's faster than the underlying GDP growth, keep in mind that the GDP is the earnings. It's like the income statement of the country is what's used to service and pay the debt. And so when you grow GDP at 4% a year and you grow debt at 8% a year, eventually there becomes a big gap between the two. Right. And that's, it used to be my Twitter pinned tweet that just shows that, you know, the GDP will no longer service the debt. And so Hirschman Capital did this fabulous study, which I put in the book, which shows that countries who, and this, by the way, this is not something new or unusual. I mean, we've got a couple hundred years of data points of countries that have done this. And the metric that generally is used is what's the ratio of the debt to the GDP. And so back in the Reagan years, the debt to GDP was 30%. And so when Volcker tightened rates, it worked. Today, the U.S. debt to GDP is about 125%. Hirschman shows that through his example, countries around the world in the last 100 years that have run up debt to GDP of about 130%. And so that means the debt is much, much larger than the GDP. And that's the point, it appears, where problems really start to occur. And in all, I think he had 11 cases, I may be wrong on that, but in all of the cases in his example, when that happens, that there becomes a currency event. And that means either there's a collapse, you know, like the Depression, or, you know, there's a lot of inflation, arguably sometimes even hyperinflation, to reset the two, to rebalance the two. And, you know, this time it's gone on a little longer than expected. And I think the reason for that is that it's at the world reserve currency level. I mean, most of those countries were not the world reserve currency when they had a problem. And arguably, it could go on longer. I can't predict that it's going to end tomorrow. But I can predict that if all those countries had trouble at 130% debt to GDP and we're at 125, we are definitely getting into the danger zone where there's a decent chance that there's going to be some kind of a currency event. And really, I say to people who ask me about it, you know, this isn't an opinion. This is mathematics. I mean, it's just pure fundamental mathematics. Now, you know, in theory, yeah, it's kind of like gravity. And so, you know, I think we're headed to a sovereign. I think we're in the beginning and the early throes of a sovereign debt crisis. I think it's going to get progressively worse. You know, I do concede that a DOGE like, you know, the Department of Government Efficiency effort in the United States, where they're trying to trim back on expenses, that is the right kind of thing to do and that will help. But I also believe that this is, you know, it's too little too late. You know, but 80% of the U.S. federal government spending is kind of locked in.
Yeah.
And to really balance the U.S. federal budget deficit, you'd have to cut, you know, all the big categories like Medicare, Social Security, defense, interest by 50%. And think about that from a voter perspective. I mean, the odds of that happening, I mean, a 50% cut in Social Security, I mean, those are long odds. So I think more likely what will happen is the government will, you know, print the money necessary to make the debt money good. That's the good news. People will get their benefits. The problem is that printing of the money, as we all know, there's a direct correlation between printing the money, mouse-click money, and money supply, and then, of course, prices. So that's why, you know, I believe we are in an inflationary decade. And the people who, you know, a lot of investors, I think, have been lulled by the fact that we were in a deflationary period for quite some time, post 1980, and they think we're going back to that. And I think they're mistaken. I don't think we're going back to that. So,
yeah, the one of the great things about the book, like, I was just blown away by the amount of charts and facts in here. Well,
maybe too much, right?
No, well, look, it illustrates the point that this is not an opinion. This right. is actual fact. Here's the chart.
Well, that's, yes. Yeah. I mean, I wanted to make a strong argument and support it with numbers and facts. And, you know, look, people can argue against it, and I'm sure people will, but The facts are the facts. And, you know, the history, the pattern is very clear that in these kinds of situations, monetary debasement is a very significant risk. And so, you know, therefore, we know the solution, right?
I think for I like it. This might be really basic, but I just know a lot of the audience, it's really because they've lived in this system their whole life, and they're most people live in a very high time preference world where they get their cash and that cash is needed right now to feed the kids, pay the rent. This whole concept of, hang on, how does inflation work? So when more money gets printed, why do prices go up? Like, could you like very simply
let's just go back to basics. Yeah. So the, so let's just take, I mean, it, you know, Milton Friedman said this originally. He said, you know, inflation is always a monetary phenomena. And, you know, I guess the way to think about prices is that an economy has the ability to generate goods and services. I mean, people work and doctors provide services and other people, you know, grow corn and, you know, provide goods and manufacture goods. And so economies operate on the ability to provide goods and services. And then money, whatever we all agree on as money, represents a claim on those goods and services. And so the goods and services have money prices based on the amount of money and the amount of goods and services. And what happens with inflation and what happens with the money supply and what happens with the Federal Reserve and the Reserve Bank of Australia, everything else, is these people have the ability to grow the amount of money in the system. And so, you know, but and that growth takes place at a rate that's larger and higher than the growth in goods and services. I mean, over time, you know, an economy will become more productive, will produce more goods and services for less inputs, because that's efficiency, and that we do have productivity growth. But so all things being equal, if suddenly helicopters came around and dropped twice as much money in the world, and of course, in COVID, they kind of did, they added 40% to the money supply. You didn't increase the goods and services by 40%. You just increased the amount of money in the system by 40%. And so it doesn't happen immediately. But over time, what will happen is the price of all those goods and services will go up by 40%. Mm. So it's you know, another way of saying it's kind of like diluting the beer. I mean, if you've got beer, which is money, and then you add 40% water to the beer, you know, now your beer doesn't taste as good.
it's very simple
because it got diluted, and that's really what happens. Your money just doesn't buy as much because, you know, the people who have the stuff to sell, you know, they have higher costs too, and so they have to pass them along. I mean, and those higher costs come in all forms, right?
And it's really evil because it's not just prices go up. What that actually really means to families is mom and dad both have to work.
Well, that's
it means
right.
That, you know, the kids are not spending as much time together with their parents. The real impact on quality of life, the spare time that dad has or mom has, she's watching podcasts or she's reading books or doing a side hustle. They're not only getting a more expensive house, but the house is on a lot of land that's half the size and build quality is lower. Yeah. So it's really insidious. And
absolutely.
It creeps into soccer practice and it creeps into dinner table and You in the talk, I've seen you talk about it, Larry. Like, this is why I like having with, you know, guys that have been around a bit longer. You can talk about America 40 years ago and what it was like, it's like today. It's just
it's just night and day. I mean, back then you could have one wage earner, the mom could stay home and cook and, you know, take care of the kids. You know, that family, I mean, even if they were blue collar, they could take a couple of vacations a year. I mean, everything was just, it was so much better. The wealth inequality was not nearly what it is today. I mean, I'm sure you reacted the way I reacted to that chart early in the book where I show how much wealth is controlled by the top 1%. I mean, it's insane, right? I mean, and really, you know, Adam, that all is a function of a system that allows those people to borrow at very, very low rates and then, you know, deploy their money at very high rates of return. And you know, if you and I could do that, we'd be billionaires too. And so, you know, these people at the top have tilted the game in their favor. And, you know, there's some people on the left wing that realize this and talk about it, and they have the wrong solution, but I'm sympathetic to their complaint. I mean, when I look at an AOC in the United States or I look at a Bernie Sanders, I mean, they talk about the billionaires and how unfair the system is, and they're right. They're absolutely right. The problem is that the solution isn't to tax those guys to death. The solution is to get the monetary system to be fair. you know, because capitalism works. I mean, capitalism, a fair form of capitalism, which we do not have, is actually the best form of way of increasing human productivity and the well-being of everybody. I mean, you know, we as bad as the system is today, even middle income to poor people today still live better than people lived in the 1800s in terms of all the benefits and things they have. So, you know, capitalism is a constant improvement of living standards for everybody. But what's happened is that the system being broken and corrupt, you know, we don't have capitalism, we have crony capitalism. And so the people at the top have managed to make themselves fabulously rich while making everybody else, you know, scrape around for the crumbs. And yes, you're right. I mean, it has decreased the quality of life. I mean, when I grew up, you know, there was a middle class. There was a big, broad middle class, and there weren't contillionaires, you know, telling us what to do. And it has crept into everything. It's crept into private equity. I mean, private equity firms now own veterinarian, you know, operations in the United States instead of, you know, back in when I grew up, we had the friendly neighborhood vet, and you know, he was an honest guy and he charged you a reasonable fee for taking care of your pets. I mean, I just had a pet die, and the pet was in, it was a dog, it was a great dog. He was screwed. He was going to die no matter what. But the PE owned, you know, veterinary clinic, they were very skillful at getting me to spend a lot of money trying to keep him alive when he was definitely destined. You know, he was dead. I mean, he had inoperable cancer, but they managed to get me to spend a lot of money trying to operate on it. So, and that's just because the private equity firms have the incentive to extract those kind of rents from you. And that happens everywhere. I mean, there's a Bitcoiner who told me about how it's happening in the dental practices. I mean, these PE firms have bought dental practices and they're coaching these dentists to turn regular fillings into root canals because they make more money.
Yeah, and it's everywhere. I read this morning that BlackRock's just bought the Suez Canal, or 90% of the Suez Canal. Like, they're going to own everything. Like,
yeah. Well, they're out buying starter homes and then upping the rents. So that, you know, my 20 year old kids can't buy houses, right? I mean, it's terrible.
I heard like something like BlackRock owns like is 60% of real estate sales in America or something, or 40% of real estate sales in America is BlackRock or something.
That sounds high to me, but they've been a participant in the market for sure. And look, it's a financialized system that benefits the financial elite. Mm. And it's designed to screw the working person. And, you know, I mean, to the working person's credit, the fighting back, I mean, I just, you know, for those who say that inflation's dead, let me give you an example. I think it's a very interesting data point. So, you know, COVID devalued everyone's income by 40% because of all the money printing. Well, in the United States, the Longshoremen Union, which is the people who unload the ships, they have a lot of power. And they were able to just negotiate a six-year contract for a 60% increase in their wages, 10% a year for 6 years. And, you know, and they deserve it because, you know, their costs have gone up that much and they're just trying to fight back. But for those who say, well, we're going back to a low inflation environment, well, how does a 10% raise, you know, per year, every year for the next 6 years? That's a long way from the Fed's 2% target, right? I mean, so we're back into an inflationary age. And it's, in my view, not going away anytime soon. And so, you know, I think, one of the reasons I wrote the book is I want to help the average citizen understand why this financial system has got them under its thumb, and then how they can fight back and why they must fight back. And furthermore, how if enough of us fight back, we can return to a sound money system. And things will get really good on the other side. That's the promise, right?
Yeah.
It's not like this is broken and never going to get fixed. It's going to get fixed. The only issue is how quickly. And you know, so I wrote the book to try and accelerate the time frame because I don't want my kids to keep living in this. You know, it's broken right now. I want my kids to live in a better world.
I want to get to like one statement you made and get over to the solution in a second. But I want people to understand why they need to care about how much money the government prints and these, because when you understand that the debt levels of the government, like in the US, you guys are sort of at a point now where the only option is to keep printing. Your debt payments are more than your military. Interest payments are more than your military. And you look at the market right now, and there's this narrative that Trump's crashing the market to bring money out of the markets back to bonds so he can refinance this $7 trillion in debt. And when you start to understand this stuff, you start to go, oh, I understand actually what's going on. And this is what happens when you get older. You have that pattern recognition skill.
Yes.
But people need to understand that, like, I remember here in Australia when the government announced all this helicopter money, everyone's cheering and I'm going, oh, my God, this is going to be bad because everybody's going to go spend it down at Best Buy or in Australia, a company called Harvey Norman. They're going to go buy a big TV. They're going to waste it on garbage. And then 3 years from now, all the prices are going, for everything's going to go up and they're going to wonder why. And then the government's blame the greedy corporations instead of themselves. And but I guess what I'm wanted to lead to there was you said in the anyway, just to close that thought for the listeners, this is why we keep banging on about, you know, you've got to get educated, because the more debt that and money that's being printed, it's going to trickle down to inflation to you. And yes, it means you're going to have to work harder and longer. Your money's going to become less. And it's really actually just theft. And it really pisses me off because we have
me too.
Doctors and nurses and public servants, good people who keep the economy and our services up. They need to be able to afford to live in a city. In Australia, we have a housing affordability crisis. And people go, well, just live somewhere else. Like, no, we need our school teachers living in the city near the schools.
Absolutely.
And so this is a real problem. And the only really way to fix it is to have an alternative. You said in the book, and I want people not to miss this, Larry, because, guys, listeners, we don't often get on somebody with Larry's experience. 41 years, you went through the 80s. You're a very modest guy, but I know in the book you talked about when you purchased 30% of Netcom, I think it was, for $2 million. You sold it for $268 million. You learned a lesson because you walked on the banks of the river in Harvard Business School with Steve Ballmer, and you sold out of Microsoft at 6 cents, and now it's $400 whatever.
Yeah, I kind of blew that one.
yeah, but this is pattern recognition and learning. And, you know, maybe you could just talk to us. In the book, you said on page 256, something which stopped me in my tracks because I respect your journey. You said, after 41 years in the business, I see Bitcoin as the single most asymmetric bet I've ever encountered. Why is that? Well, first of all, for the people who don't know, what does asymmetric mean? And why did you make that statement, which is a big statement for a guy like you who's been around the space for a long time?
Yeah. So first of all, let's define asymmetric. Asymmetric, when you're making investments, and this is, I don't know if you remember the part of the book where I was sitting with my first boss at Continental Illinois, and he said to me, and we were in the venture capital business, he said to me, he defined asymmetry for me. He said to me, Larry, this business is a really great business. I said, why, John? He said, well, because you can only lose 1x what you put up. And if you're right, you can make 2x, 5x, 10x, 15x. And he had bought into Apple Computer with the bank's money, $500,000. He turned it into, I don't know, $80 million in 1979 or something. And that's asymmetry. Asymmetry is a bet where your downside, you know, losing all your money is really shitty. Don't get me wrong. That's a lot of downside. But if you've got a chance, if you're making a bet where you can lose all your money, but if you're right, you can make 2 to 100 times your money. Well, unless it's a 99% chance you're going to lose all your money, you know, maybe it's a 50% flip or maybe it's only 30%. The upside justifies taking the risk that it doesn't work. So that's asymmetry, where your reward is so much bigger mathematically than your loss, that if you take a bunch, if your probability of outcome is decent, you take a bunch of those bets, you'll have a few losses, but you'll come out way ahead because when you're right, you'll make 2 to 100 times your money. So that's asymmetry, okay? And my career has been all about asymmetry as an investor, as a venture capitalist, et cetera. And my career has been all about trying to find something, you know, trying to find a macro trend that is going to last for a bunch of years. And, you know, you'll also remember in the book where I point out that, you know, like the gains on Google or the gains on Facebook or the gains on Amazon, those were all extremely asymmetric bets based upon a technological change. Okay. And I think that Bitcoin is an asymmetric bet based on the monetary system changing. And I think that Bitcoin is a new monetary system. It's different. It's absolutely, it's an innovation along the lines of learning to fly or the car or the, you know, the printing press or whatever. It's a different form of money. Adam, as you know, but maybe your listeners don't, this is the first form of money that has ever existed that cannot be diluted. that sounds just kind of simple and basic, but think about that. There will only ever be 21 million of these things. And so, and the value, money has value. Historically, money has had value because it's not dilutable. I mean, gold was chosen as the best form of money, you know, prior to Bitcoin, because, you know, it's hard to find it. And the supply of gold grows at 1.7% a year, which means that every 50 years, you know, the amount of gold on the planet will double. Well, Bitcoin is harder than gold because the supply of Bitcoin is algorithmically determined. And as you and I both know, it's 21 million. It'll never be larger than that. So therefore, that's different. That's a new and different thing. It's a technological innovation. I think it's important for people to understand that. Once you understand that and you realize that it, you know, that as Safe says, you know, the soundest form of money always wins. Then you come to the conclusion that eventually all the money is going to go into Bitcoin. And, you know, in my view, you know, this thing is, I mean, it's at 80,000 now, it's going to 1 million, then it's going to 10 million, then it's going to higher than that. As Michael Saylor lays out, you know, it's going up forever, Laura. And so I think people have a hard time getting their head around that because they haven't done the work to study it and to understand it. And don't get me wrong, there are risks inherent in it, and those are laid out in the book. I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna about this. I'm not just, you know, some crazy young guy, you know, in love with Bitcoin. You know, I've considered it for a lot of years. I started buying it in 2013, 14, and I was quite skeptical in the early years that it was going to work technologically. But now we're 16 years into it. We've got 870,000 blocks that have been processed. There haven't been any trouble. And, you know, it to me, the risk of its failure are quite low. And in fact, you know, if you look at the adoption rates and the, you know, the price history of it, I think it's just going to continue to absorb the monetary system. So that's how I come to the conclusion. I mean, in the venture capital business, I always adhere to the dictum that, you know, are the dogs eating the food and are there more dogs eating the food in increasing numbers, you know, and that as long as the dogs are eating the food, you know, and the trend is your friend, you know, you stick with an investment. And so, yeah. You know, we got a lot of dogs eating this food, but ironically, and Adam, you'll know this too. You know, a lot of people, and I encounter this a lot, people say, well, I'm too late. You know, it's at 100,000. You bought it at 400 or 10,000, whatever. You know, I've got it at all kinds of prices. I paid 50,000 for a lot of it, but and they'll say, well, I'm too late, but they're really not, because, you know, the total assets in the world are about $900 trillion. And when Bitcoin was at 100,000, it was about, you know, $2 trillion. So Bitcoin is 2/10 of the total financial assets in the world, if you include real estate. So, you know, 2/10, the soundest form of money ever devised by mankind being rapidly adopted represents 0.2% of all the financial assets in the world. I mean, it could go to $1 million a coin and it would still only be 2%. And there have been times, by the way, when gold has represented 10% of the financial assets in the world. So, you know, my view is you are not too late if you're looking at it at this price. But a lot of people have that anchoring tendency where they say, well, you know, you got it cheaper. I don't want to pay. And I had that. I mean, I remember Max Kaiser telling me he bought a bunch of it at $2 and I was jealous, you know. but hey,
I got to get Max on the pod. He is
he's classic. I'll help you get him on. I mean, you know, but he was a visionary and he understood it and he believed. And
yeah.
And he looked past the risk. And by the way, there were a lot of substantial risks back then. And,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
All the
risk adjusted basis.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, arguably the risks are down a lot now. I mean, one of the great risks that people used to always talk about is governments are going to kill this thing. Well, that's kind of not so much a risk anymore since we have an ETF in the United States and since we have an administration that's, you know, talking about stacking it as a reserve. So now that could all change. I mean, if Team Blue wins, they could go back the other way. But the point I'm trying to make is that a lot, you know, technologically, you know, we had the block size wars, you know, we had SegWit, we had, you know, the forks, et cetera. I mean, a lot of the risks, in my opinion, have been hammered out of it.
I think, Larry, I want people to really not miss what you just said. Guys, you are listening to a guy whose 41-year career has been patent recognition here. He's worked through the 80s and the 90s in the tech space as an investor with millions of dollars in funds that he manages for himself and investors. And he's just told us that this is a great asymmetric bet. But what I want you to really not miss is when Larry said, this is hard money. I want you to understand, that's a term, but I want you to understand what it means. When you go to work and you put your, you know, Jack Mallers, who's one of my favorite speakers.
Yeah, I love Jack.
Money is an abstracted expression of our time. So when we go to work, we put in the labor, they give us cash. It's a way to store our time and energy. Unfortunately, this form of cash leaks because the issuers just keep printing more of it. So the longer we hold it, the less it becomes, which is theft. So if we have a form of money that is emerging that we can give to somebody, a hard money that cannot be diluted. So a school teacher can go to work today, get paid $100, and then in 10 years, that $100 is still worth $100 or maybe more. That is a far superior form of money. Yeah. Exactly. And just like the internet won, and it got, you know, it democratized information, it changed the world. We are on team B for plan B, hoping that this form of money, which is a moral, ethical proof of work system, which means, you know, if that wins, the upside, what Larry's just laid out, is that there's 900 trillion of assets right now. It's worth 0.2% of the global assets. And it has no counterparty risk. There is nobody on the other side of it that can meddle with it. And you, in the book on page 307, you laid out the president's address because, you know, you get asked the question, how would you actually change? What would the US president have to say in order to introduce Bitcoin and gold as sound money again? And it was very interesting because you said in that speech, from today, the US government will recognize gold, silver, and Bitcoin, and we will not dictate which one's going to win. It's going to be up to you guys. And I, when you said that, I'm sitting here going, oh my God, I will bet on that fight all day long.
Of course you will. Yeah. Yeah. Bitcoin wins naturally. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm all in on Bitcoin. If there were three fighters in the ring, there's only one winner.
That's exactly right. I mean, there really only can be one, but it'll take time. I mean, you know, and there's a chance that in the transition, some other countries will bet on gold. I mean, China has definitely bet on gold in a big way. Mm-hmm. But I think the strategic Bitcoin reserve, it has to have every military in every country in the world thinking to themselves, huh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And it would be strategically for the US, it would be a brilliant move to do what Saylor says, which would be to sell the gold and buy Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, it takes, all of these changes take time. Mm-hmm. And that's the bad news. The good news is it's that time that gives you, you know, gives all investors, you know, the opportunity to buy it today at a price that I think is cheap. I think $80,000 is quite cheap relative to what it is and where it can go. So, you know, most investors may not feel that way, but I certainly do.
It should be clear for listeners who are new to Bitcoin, you can buy a part of a Bitcoin. You don't have
I dealt with that today. I was at the post office and she said, I was talking to a woman there. I gave her the book and she's become my friend because I've been mailing out books. And she said, yeah, but Larry, I don't have $80,000.
Yeah.
And I said, Chrissy, no problem. You know, I mean, you can buy a tenth of a Bitcoin. You can buy a hundredth of a Bitcoin. I mean, you can put $80, $100. I mean, pick a number, you know, figure out how much you can save every week and then use it to buy Bitcoin. You know, get a Strike application, get a Strike, you know, account, get a River account, you know, and off you go.
I got a couple of other questions before we wind it up for you. That I'd love you to cover, because I do want to finish by getting you to walk through how this might actually
happen. Yeah, it's hard to know, but yeah, we can go there.
We'll go there in a minute. I've got a question for myself. Do you own anything else, or just are you a Bitcoin maxi? Like, for example, when I say anything else, I mean other forms of Bitcoin. For example, do you own any ETFs? Do you own strategy or micro strategy stock?
Yeah.
Are you pure Bitcoin only?
First of all, I mean, I think Bitcoin is the best, most asymmetric bet, and it's probably become 70% of my liquid assets. I mean, I own a couple of places where I live. They're paid for. They're modest, and you know, that's, I don't view them as investments. I need a place to stay. In terms of my investment stuff, I own gold and silver. You know, physical gold and silver. And I still manage a gold and silver mining stock fund, which over time I will unwind as those continue to work and get to higher valuations. I owe my investors in that fund good returns, and I'm going to deliver good returns to them in the next few years because, you know, all these assets are going to go up. Bitcoin's going to go up faster, but gold and silver are going to go up faster. I didn't start off with, you know, a 70% allocation to Bitcoin. It kind of grew to that level. You know, I bought it a lot cheaper. It's gone up a lot. And I do own MicroStrategy. I believe very much in Michael and what he's doing. And I believe in that company being, you know, asymmetric on top of asymmetric. He's kind of cracked the code for how to use the volatility as a way to finance himself. So I own some of that too. But my largest holding by far is just native Bitcoin. In terms of the ETFs, yeah, I own some of those. I'll tell you where they tend to reside. In the United States, you have these things, these 401k plans, these IRAs, and so on and so forth. And it's cumbersome to move those out and get those into self-directed, all that kind of stuff. So you know, when I have from prior employers, I have some plans that are like that. And I said, well, I want to be exposed to Bitcoin. When the ETF came along, I just bought Bitcoin and those.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't view that as good as owning native Bitcoin. I mean, there's always the risk that the government says, hey, you know, those ETFs, we're going to send it in and we're going to give you cash. I mean, that, you know, the 6102 risk, which is the executive order that FDR used when he tried to basically, you know, get when he confiscated all the gold. So, but principally on Bitcoin.
Yeah. I agree. I think the ETFs and MicroStrategy, which is really a proxy for Bitcoin, are great for your 401k, or in Australia, what we call our superannuation. I put my entire 401k or superannuation into some MicroStrategy back in 2020 something.
That turns out to be a good move, huh?
It was a good move. It was a very good move. But I just went 100% on that, which was really good. Just my own interest, what was it like meeting Michael Saylor?
He is fantastic. I've been on a stage with him once. I've met him once a couple times.
He invited me out of the villa. Like, what's that like? I mean, that's on my goals list, is to go and get to one of Michael's parties.
You will. You get over here and go to the show and I'll introduce you to him. I mean, you know, he's a super nice guy. He's also extremely competitive. He wants to win. He totally embraces the mission. I think he'll end up probably the richest guy in the world. I think he actually wants to be president someday, and my sense is he'll probably make it to that role. I think he's very much a patriot, believes in the United States and the Constitution and what it stands for. It is kind of humbling to be in his presence. I mean, if you've watched his videos and you've seen things, I mean, he's an intellect that's just, it's kind of scary how intellectually smart he is and how his recall of facts and knowledge and everything else. I mean,
His articulation is just off the charts.
It really is. I mean, I talk about it in the book that everyone should go listen to that Atlas Society speech where he walks through kind of a history. You know, he's a great historian as an engineer. And I think one thing, you know, engineers seem to get this. I mean, Lynn Alden's an engineer. Preston Pish is an engineer. I mean, engineers tend to get it because this really is a technical development. And that the Atlas Society speech, where he talks about the history of technology and how, you know, each new technical development came along and took us to a new level, and that Bitcoin is just the natural progression in that chain, I think it's just brilliant and very much worth people's time to listen to.
Yeah. Now if you don't know who we're talking about, Michael Saylor, you can learn more at his website, hope.com. But, you know, watch anything Michael says about Bitcoin and, you know, we all just sort of bow the knee in respect.
Yeah, he's been just a fabulous, fabulous boon to the space. And, you know, I mean, look, I mean, Safe's book is what orange-pilled him. I mean, Safe is going to go down in history, in my opinion, as the most important economist of the 20th century, because he realized this early and he orange-pilled all of us. And he orange-pilled Saylor, et cetera. I mean, just an incredible intellect. And, you know, just can't say enough good things about what he's done for this whole movement. And, you know, it's kind of thrilling. I mean, I look at a lot of these old, I mean, I've been around the sound money world for a long time. I know a lot of guys who were very sound money, big sound money advocates, but they missed this. You know, I mean, the Peter Schiffs used to be a friend. I mean, you know, guys like James Grant, who runs Grant's Interest Rate Observer. I mean, I tried to talk him in. I said, look, Jim, I mean, you know, using Menger's definition, this is becoming money. You know, it's being accepted. It's sound. He said, yeah, come back to me when you got 1,000 years of history. I said, Jim, you know, when they invented the airplane, did you say, hey, let's wait 1,000 years to see if flying really makes sense? I mean, you know, it's a technical innovation. And sadly, just a lot a lot of the Sound Money crew just hasn't figured that out yet, and that's unfortunate. But
and it's an opportunity for those listening, like for the hardworking mums and dads out there. When I first started, I listened to Michael Saylor and I listened to Pomp and I listened to you, and I was like, these guys are all smarter than me. They're all more experienced than me. I'm just going to buy some, and that sort of started my journey. And then, you know, listening to Preston, I've got Preston coming on the pod shortly, and I love the name of the company, Ego Death Capital, and listening to Jeff Booth and all these guys. It really is that. I mean, it really is the slaughtering of your ego, and you bend the knee eventually and you realize, oh my God, like I've been living in a dream. An illusion.
Yeah, the fiat guys, I mean, and one of the reasons I think a lot of them haven't adopted it is the existing system has been very good to them. They've done really well. They don't need it. You know, I mean, Warren Buffett, he doesn't need it. In fact, and that's why he calls it rat poison, because it scares him. You know, it's
on a need to know basis, right? Like he doesn't need to know. Why would you do the 1,000 hours when you're Warren Buffett? You don't need to.
Right. I mean, one of the guys that I'm actually most impressed by, and I didn't particularly like him because he was really a fiat lord, but you know, I have to say, I have to, you know, tip the hat to Larry Fink, you know, who runs BlackRock. So BlackRock is a big fiat shop. And, you know, originally he said, you know, it was bad, and he was a very big, he was very negative on it. And, you know, but he looked at it and he did the work. And I think what happened is he came to the conclusion that, well, this is going to work with me or without me. And I've either got to get on board and figure out a way to make money off it, which he's done with IBIT, the largest ETF, or, you know, I'm going to get left behind. And of course, the guy who got left behind was a guy who was running Vanguard at the time, who said, no, this is all bullshit. And, you know, the ETFs launched and he lost his job. So, you know, it's a humbling thing. I mean, it's hard to admit if you're in the existing system, it's hard to admit that there's a better and different system. I mean, I've been interacting with the dean of the Harvard Business School saying, guys, you know, this is the West Point of capitalism. You're supposed to understand when things like this change, when big things like this change. And this is a huge change. And he just can't get his arms around it. He just can't get his head around it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is a difficult concept, but, you know, things are changing. And, time will. I think it's a true test, a true sign of intelligence and courage when somebody high profile, but anybody, but the higher the profile, the higher stakes, is willing to say we were wrong on this, knowing that there's receipts of them saying Bitcoin's a scam. You know, like Larry Fink has got so many receipts out there saying Bitcoin's for drug dealers, Bitcoin's a scam, for them, for him to then stop and say I was wrong and we're now doing this. Now it's easy to be cynical and say, well, of course he's figured out how to make money out of it, so now he's
just, he can make money off it, but
it's,
But I think he honestly gets it. I mean, he calls it digital gold. I mean, another guy who I think is an honest guy is Ray Dalio, who was a fiat lord. And,
correct.
You know, he was always a gold guy because he understood, you know, the sovereign debt crisis issue that we're in. And, you know, he now gets it and he owns it. And he's starting to call it digital gold. And, you know, look, this is how all new things get adopted. I mean, I remember the skepticism around the internet. I mean, in the early days with, you know, dial-up and green screen, we didn't even have Windows yet. You know, the internet was just kind of a toy. And it's like, well, why would somebody need to send email around the world? It doesn't really matter. I was like, what? You know, it really does matter. And you couldn't see how it was all going to work.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't foresee that you and I would be talking halfway around the world video real time. But you could foresee that the development was in the right direction and that over time, it was going to become much more important. And the same is true with Bitcoin. I mean, as a medium of exchange, it's still not working. Lightning's got a long way to go. But, you know, you can see that we're going in that direction and we're going to get there. You know?
Could you maybe just close by sharing your thoughts? I watch Swan Bitcoin from time to time, and there's a famous thing they say at the end of all their videos, slowly at first, then all at once.
Yeah.
Maybe you could speak to that. Like, in actual reality, I don't think people realize how touchy, like this tipping point concept that Malcolm Gladwell talks about, you express in the book, that when that tipping point happens and people start to not trust the currency and they start running for the exits and they go, where can we put our money? Because most people in Australia and America, wealthy, wealthy countries, they don't understand. Like, I loved in the book where you gave real human examples of the impact that safe money has, sound money, safe money, like Leila Ferzan, you know, the Afghan programmer, you know, who they stole all her money. The terrorists stole all her money, but thankfully she had money stored in Bitcoin that's now worth $250,000. We talked about FOPE Diop, you know, the Senegal currency halved overnight. But most Westerners, like in America and Australia, can't imagine this ever happening. But how quickly and how fragile that trust is. And once it tips, and then what that might mean in terms of Bitcoin acceleration.
Yeah, that's a great, great point. And I tried to make that throughout the book. And we don't really know. None of us know what the future holds. But it is safe to say that, you know, we're in a theater and, that's smoldering. And a few people, Bitcoiners, know that it's on fire. And so we've already hit the exit. But everyone else is still comfortable in the theater. And they can't really, they're just getting whiffs of the smoke. And, you know, at some point in time, the smoke's going to become obvious. And at that point in time, you know, Bitcoin could go up very, very rapidly as a result of a rush out of fiat currencies. To address your broader question of the timing of all of this, Adam, I mean, Michael has said to me and others that Saylor, he thinks we're in the next 10 years of kind of what he would call the gold rush of Bitcoin adoption. And I kind of feel the same way. If you look at a lot of the curves, you look at internet adoption, et cetera, it feels to me like we're right at that knee where the adoption rate starts to get substantially quicker. The gradually is moving toward the suddenly. It just kind of feels to me, and that's just a gut sense. And I had some good charts in the book too about how other things were adopted. You know, when cell phones first came out, you know, it was $1 a minute. I got a boss who, you know, like the guy in Wall Street, you know, was walking around with a big clunky cell phone paying $1 a minute. He needed it because he was trading and all that stuff. So, you know, and of course now we all have cell phones with kind of unlimited minutes for $30. But and that, you know, you reach a tipping point where an innovation becomes obvious and everybody wants it. And it feels to me like we're getting there. You also, you know, it coincides with what's going on in the federal government and the nothing stops this train meme of, you know, they just can't stop printing money because of the deficits that they're running. And so as a result of all of that taking place, you know, it's going to become a more pressing issue, in my opinion, relatively certainly. This is a fourth turning in my view, and that's a whole other book everyone should read. But what that means is it's all the societal rules change in fourth turnings. The last one was World War II, then the Civil War, then the American Revolution. Fourth turnings tend to last about 20 to 30 years. This one started in 08, in my opinion. So if it were 20 years, that would mean it would wrap up by 2028. I don't know that we'll get it wrapped up there. That's only 3 years from now. But I think by the mid-2030s, you know, the monetary system is going to look a lot different than it does today.
Yeah.
Because I think that, you know, the problems are very obvious. They're becoming, you're seeing real big mainstream people saying, you know, this is unsustainable. We cannot continue to run these deficits. Hell, Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, I mean, the guy who kind of enables it all, has said it. I sent him a copy of the book. I was like, dude, wake up. You know, you're saying this, but you're enabling it. What are you doing? You know, so look, it basically, I feel like, you know, it's going to be a kind of a tumultuous, you know, 5 to 10 years as we make this transition from unsound money to sound money. And the reason why I think we'll go to sound money is that once it becomes clear how broken unsound money is, everyone will come to the same conclusion. Do you know what I mean? Everyone will.
I don't want to trust any government right. issued money of China, Russia, America. Bitcoin exactly. sitting there on its own with no counterparty, with no yeah. issuer, as a trustless.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just logical.
Yeah, exactly. It's just going to happen. So, you know, but to the you know the time. I mean, it's not. I mean, none of us really know, right?
But it
feels. You know, look. I mean. You know, 2 or 3 years ago when you got into it, or, you know, just going back a ways, I mean, you know, would you have thought we'd have an ETF? Would you thought we'd have a Bitcoin conference with two, you know, two presidential candidates were in Nashville last year, RFK and Donald Trump, courting the Bitcoin vote. I mean, come on, right?
You got J.D. Vance, he's got half his net worth in Bitcoin. JFK's got 80% of it.
Right, right, right. You got BlackRock, which is the largest, you know, arguably a big fiat shop, but you got the guy running BlackRock, you know, saying it's digital gold. You got Ray Dalio, the largest hedge fund guy, saying, you know, it's digital gold. You've got one of the best hedge fund investors ever, Paul Tudor Jones, saying Bitcoin is the fastest horse in the monetary debasement race. And really, we are in a world of monetary debasement. We all know that. I mean, it's, you know, so to me, People who are listening to this, people who are aware of it, people who are thinking of getting in, you're not too late. But, you know, in a couple of years, you're going to be later. in a couple of years, you know, I fully expect in this cycle that we're going to go to $200,000 or $300,000 a coin. And so having bought it at 80, you know, you're going to feel better. And that's the way it always works. I know people now are saying, well, gosh, you bought it at 10 and it's at 80. And I think, yeah, that's true. But, you know, 5-6 years from now, you know, it'll be at 800 and people say, hang on, it's like you bought it at 80 and it's at 800. That's up 10x. And yeah. And of course, those buyers will then, you know, 10 years later, it'll be at 8 million or whatever the number is, but it'll be a bigger number. And you know, the early buyers, there's a fixed supply and that's the issue, right? And therefore, it is destined to go up for a very, very long time.
And global, the change 24/7. And that's the other part that people don't realize. I saw that, I started in 2018 and I just saw this is a global narrative with a fixed supply. There's, where a lot of people miss is just the market capitalization concept of there's 21 million coins. How much is it? They look at the price of per coin instead of the value of the overall network relative. For Aussies listening to this, to give you an idea, people say, oh, it's not a thing, in the book, Larry highlighted and ranked the value of global currencies like the US dollar all the way down.
Yeah.
Bitcoin's actually worth more than the Australian dollar, which is number 12. And in the list of global currency values, Bitcoin is worth more than all of the Australian dollars in circulation, which is remarkable. Really very, very interesting. Matt, I think I had something I was going to ask you, but I think I'm out, guys. If you haven't already made the decision to get this book, please make sure you do. It's called The Big Print. It is an absolute cracker. I read the whole thing. It's 340 pages. It's fantastic. Is it on audio yet or not?
No, it should be out any day now. Walker America is reading it for me because I don't have time to read it. He's got a better voice than I do. So the audio version will be out soon. I've got a lot of requests for it, but we're working through that. It is available on Kindle. The EPUB version now works. The first version was kind of flawed, which I apologize for. If we want to make the world a better place, we've got to fix this monetary problem. And, you know, you can fix it in terms of what you do yourself. But then the thing I would say, and I really hope happens, is that if you read the book and you agree with it, then you pass it on to other people, because that's how, you know, we need to, the sooner we can get away from this broken system and move and migrate into a better system, which is what this is, the sooner, you know, a lot of these problems of wealth inequality and inflation and, you know, the war. Yeah. I mean, there's so many things that that's a discussion unto itself. There's just a lot of things that I believe this will make and improve in the world. And you know, these things were all going to happen with or without me, but I wrote the book to try and push it along because we all have a limited time here. And so I wanted to see things happen sooner rather than later. So I wrote the book.
Are you going to be in Vegas for Bitcoin?
I will be in Vegas. I'll just schedule. I'm going to BitBlock Boom in Dallas next month. I'll be at Cheat Code in Bedford I think that's next month too. Wow. I'll be in Vegas, and then I will be in Prague. And I'm happy to sign anybody's book. Just walk up and say hello. And then after that, I don't know. I learned a new term the other day. My wife said she's a book widow. She's pissed off at me spending all my time on the book and all my time on book pods. And she's right. It's unfair. And so after we get a little further down the road, and I do these shows, I'm going to spend more time with my wife, and the book will be out there and you guys can all read it, but I won't be doing quite as much of this.
I'll probably see you in Vegas. I'm booked to go to
Vegas. I hope so. Absolutely.
And we'll be in Prague as well. So I'll see you.
Oh, great. Well, we'll see you at both of those. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it'd be good. Yeah. Well, thank you, Larry, for your time.
Oh, thank you. Great questions. And obviously you've really read the book and I appreciate that. And hopefully we can get some traction here and change the world. That's the goal, right?
Yeah, dude, I can feel the goodness, you know, in your intention. And that's what I love about this community is just the willingness for remarkable people to come and talk and share. Just it's so easy to get an appointment with quality people because it's got a real community and a real.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, it's, One of the things, I think Jeff Booth said this to me once, and I think Saylor said it as well. It's what's really fun about the Bitcoin community is that we're all working for each other.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like I'm working for you and Saylor's working for me and Booth is working for both of us. We're all, you know, we've got this thing that we think is going to really make the world a better place. And we all do our little part. I mean, you know, you're doing your pod. I did my book. Saylor's buying billions of dollars of the shit. I mean, Jeff,
you said that in the book, and it was actually a great line where you said, the minute you buy Bitcoin is the minute that Michael Saylor works for you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, holy shit. Like, that's actually true.
It is true, right? Saylor's a really bright guy.
I'm like, holy shit, 100%. Yeah.
We all work for each other. I mean, we're all on Team Bitcoin, and you're right. I mean, I find in general I love Bitcoiners because, you know, they're not in it for the money as much as they're in it for making the world a better place.
We all start for the money, but we end in it.
Yeah. You realize there are all these other subsidiary benefits. And yeah. And also, you know, I would say to people who are listening, I mean, once you get into this, you really, a sense of peace kind of develops. You just get, before this, I was really worried about my retirement or worried if I was going to have enough money. I just felt like life was a continual struggle.
Yeah.
I don't know if you feel this way, but I just don't feel like it's not so much of a struggle anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's very satisfying to know that, you know, this is going to work and we're going to be financially comfortable and the world's going to get better. And I mean, it's a very hopeful kind of place to be once you fully understand it.
I had Michael Dunworth on the pod and he said,
he's great. I love him. Yeah.
He's hilarious. But he said the same thing. He said, life is not for worrying. We're not built that way.
No.
We both lamented that exact fact of the peace that it brings when you truly understand it. But guys listening, it doesn't just happen from one podcast. I've spent literally thousands of hours, and even now, thousands of hours later, I'm still having these understandings. It takes that long to just get this fiat Ponzi, you know, mindset that we've lived in our entire life out of our system, and to actually understand this. And I know it sounds like we're talking about a religion. I know it sounds weird, but you know, I really,
once you start, though, I mean, it's a fun thing to learn, and there are a lot of great resources. There are tons of free pods. There are a handful of books you can read, and you know, you can get the gist of it pretty quickly. And once you go down the rabbit hole, you know, it's a fun place to be. So,
yeah,
highly recommended.
Lawrence Lepard, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Adam. Really great to spend time with you. I appreciate the intelligence of your questions. Clearly, you get it, and you've read the book carefully, so I certainly appreciate it. When you get this done, will you make sure you flip me the link so I can rebroadcast and all that?
Yeah, I will indeed. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, and bye for now.
Thanks. We'll see you.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.